The Guardian.
Hello, this is Science Weekly. I'm Alok Char. We've got a semi-special edition of the programme this week, partly dedicated to the British Science Festival, an event that took place in Bradford here in the UK last week. On the show, we'll hear about the scientific study of happiness, how we can recycle food waste using a giant microwave, we'll investigate the dark matter of the genome, and get some tantalising insights into the dark matter of the cosmos. Plus, Science Weekly is about to go on the road. Keep listening for how to join us for a live recording. This is Science Weekly from The Guardian. This year's British Science Festival was hosted at the University of Bradford. And as we breezed into this hilly post-industrial city, we were joined by the tail end of Hurricane Katia. The festival was a very windy affair. Aha, that's better. Yes, buffeted by the high winds, the cream of the UK science community presented their very latest research to the international media. Well, actually, that's not quite true. But we did hunt high and low for some interesting tales for you. So this edition, we're going to bring you a selection of interviews from these presentations. Let's start the proceedings with a bang. For Science Weekly, producer Jason spoke to Dr. Liz Rylett about her work on using genetically modified plants to clean up the toxic waste on weapons testing ranges. Liz started by describing particular chemicals that her plants are meant to clean out of the soil.
There are two problems here. The TNT remains bound tightly to the soil column, a little bit like Velcro, whereas the RDX is more of your kind of vindaloo curry. It washes very quickly through the groundwater and into the groundwater and away into drinking water supplies if it's not removed. So we need to address both problems. We need plants that can withstand the toxic Velcro and remove the vindaloo RDX as it passes very rapidly through the soil column.
So you basically have kind of two genetic problems in a way. You've basically TNT tolerance and then some way of using the RDX to take nitrogen. I think that's what we're talking about here, isn't it? Using the nitrogen in the RDX as basically fertilizer as plant
exactly
food.
That's it. A serendipitous part of our research was the discovery that when we engineered plants with the ability to degrade RDX, they were able to use it as a nitrogen source and grow a little bit like how you might add a fertilizer to a plant.
You do have a kind of a test plant. Could you tell us a little bit about that, something that's starting to do what you want to do?
Okay, well, to make the test plant, first of all, we went back to the training ranges and we identified bacteria on the training range that were able to detoxify the TNT and to break down the RDX. We isolated those bacteria and isolated the genes in our laboratories, and then we put them into our model plant species, which is Arabidopsis. This is like a younger sibling to oilseed rape that you see out in the fields. And we were able to transform this very readily to put these bacterial genes into this plant. And once we'd done that, we quickly found that these plants were able to grow on this toxic Velcro TNT soil and very readily remove the RDX from the soil water.
How did you trial that? How did you test that in the lab?
Well, in the lab, we mocked up plants in pots and then watered them with saturated solutions of RDX to try and mimic the effects of a storm on the training range, and we found that the plants were able to remove the RDX from the soil column within a few hours.
And I take it that the soil column had TNT in it. It was
yes, the plants had been grown in TNT, so they were able to withstand that toxicity too.
This is fantastic, but you need to find a plant, I guess, that can cope with extreme conditions in these firing ranges.
Yes, the conditions on the firing ranges certainly are extreme. A big problem is that the military drive very heavy tanks over the machinery, and our little Arabidopsis plants are a little bit like a lettuce and they get very, very readily crushed.
You actually used the lettuce in the presentation, I know.
yeah, that's
It doesn't fare well to being stamped on, I know.
No, even less well to being flame-throwed, so the tanks can literally burn off the grassland on the training range. And finally, the effects of the plants when the explosives detonate on the ground, they literally blow the plants off the face of the planet. So we need some plants that are incredibly robust, that are able to withstand all of these different terrible things that happen to them on the training range.
Yeah. So I think you were saying that there are plants that deal well with these training ranges, Siberian grasses, and that's the kind of plant that you're hoping to use out in on the test site in the real world. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. The plants that we're now looking at transforming are Western Siberian and slender wheatgrass species predominantly, as these are grass species that are found native on the training ranges, and we know that they can withstand all of that the army throw at them. So that's what we're targeting now.
Moving on now to genetics. From chemical cleaning plants to some interesting new work on the way DNA controls our desire for fatty foods and alcohol. No such control was in evidence by the attendees at this year's festival, mind you. Our reporter, Nathan Green, spoke to Dr. Alistair McKenzie from the University of Aberdeen about his work on what he calls the dark matter of the genome. Previously, scientists referred to this stuff as junk DNA because it doesn't contain any genes and therefore doesn't code for proteins. Thing is, this non-coding part makes up more than 95% of the DNA in our cells. Dr. McKenzie started by telling Nathan what his team had uncovered about the power of this much-neglected stretch of the human genome.
We recently had a paper in Neuropsychopharmacology which described the discovery of a switch that controls a gene called galenin. And galenin has been known for some time that galenin is involved in controlling food preference through its expression in part of the brain called the hypothalamus. So if you have mice which overexpress, overproduce galenin in the hypothalamus, they tend to have a preference for fatty foods and ethanol. Whereas if you knock out this gene, the galenin gene, these animals don't drink ethanol and they have less of a preference for fatty foods. So we were interested in finding out what the switches were which controlled this gene in the hypothalamus. And we used what's called comparative genomics, where you take the genome sequences of several different species, including human, and you line them up around in the region of the genome around the galenin gene. And what we found was that, yes, the galenin gene obviously had been conserved through 310 million years of evolution. And so you could actually say that the galenin gene would have also influenced, if you could infer that the galenin gene also influenced alcohol and fat preferences of dinosaurs, but that's just a little bit of Hawking. What was very interesting about comparing these regions of the genome was that in addition to the conservation of the gene itself, there was other areas surrounding the galenin gene, quite a distance from the galenin gene, which had been hugely conserved, even more than the protein coding region. And this was just a beacon of telling us there was something important there. It wouldn't have been conserved for 310 million years, this tiny sequence, if it wasn't important. So we isolated this sequence and we found that it was a switch that actually controlled the expression of galenin in the hypothalamus. We went a step further and we reproduced the variations within the switch in the human population. We reproduced the two versions of the switch which exist in the human population, and we were able to show that they had different activities depending on the mutations or the variations within the switch. So we found a strong switch and we found a weak switch, and the weak switch exists in 10% of the European population, whereas the majority of us have the stronger switch. We were also able to use various generic drug treatments. When I say generic, I mean treatments which are known to alter signaling mechanisms within the cell. We were able to manipulate these signaling mechanisms, and we were able to find out which one of these pathways, signaling pathways within the cell, altered the activity or affected the activity of the switch.
So taking this to a conclusion, what's the aim? Is it to ultimately be able to control people's alcohol and food intake?
In this immediate case, yes. Our eventual aim, we're interested in studying the galenin switch because of the evidence that it may be involved in controlling galenin in the hypothalamus. We need to do a lot more experiments to show it is involved. What we've discovered so far is very tantalizing, and it's not been done before, but there's still a number of quite large steps to take before we can actually say, yes, this is the absolute switch that controls ghrelin, and yes, these are the drug treatments that will control it and change people's appetite for alcohol and fat. But the information, the ground of the information is there. The plateau we can now push forward on is I think quite strong. But there's huge amounts of information out there we still need to gather. It's our very early days, but the data we have so far is very tantalizing. We're really interested in proceeding with this work, and we're actually looking for funds to push this forward.
A familiar pitch for funding there on behalf of the University of Aberdeen. Well, from the dark matter of the genome to the dark matter of the cosmos.
I'm Professor Carlos Frank. I'm the Ogden Professor of Fundamental Physics at the Institute for Computational Cosmology in the University of Durham.
One of my personal highlights of the festival was a chat with Professor Carlos Frank. He's a brilliant cosmologist at the vanguard of our understanding of the universe, and also a funny and profound science communicator as well. He used a lecture at the festival to explore the boundaries of our scientific understanding of the missing bits of our universe. He had some sobering thoughts for scientists working at the Large Hadron Collider, and for other cosmologists who he thinks might have to accept that some of their theories of the universe might be all wrong.
So far, we have a null result. Now, maybe, you know, it could be that perhaps all these claims of discoveries is because we're on the verge, really, of discovering it. The instruments are now sensitive enough that they're beginning to give hints. That's a possibility. But another possibility, maybe, that we're looking for the wrong kind of
so
particle.
So supersymmetry itself might not be right.
Well, there is a possibility. There was a report just a couple of weeks ago on the BBC that particle physicists are getting nervous in Geneva, in CERN, because supersymmetry should have been seen and hasn't yet been seen. So there is an element of doubt creeping up that maybe this whole thing is not the way the universe works.
Well, because this is, I suppose, interesting about thing about particle physics and cosmology is that you can do simulations and predictions and theory, and these things are very important in this subject. But ultimately, it is about measurement and detection. So the supersymmetry theory is elegant and beautiful, but if you don't find those particles, it's got to be thrown out the window.
Well, but that's exactly the key point, that any theory is only as good as the predictions it makes. And it has to live or die by its predictions. Cold dark matter theory, based on supersymmetric particles, is very definitive about the predictions. And if the predictions don't come true, we have to drop the theory.
We'll bring you an extended interview with Professor Frank soon enough, but we thought we'd tease you with that little clip for now. Now for something completely different. From cosmic spheres to citrus ones. One of the most startling presentations at the festival this year was by James Clark, Professor of Green Chemistry at the University of York. Professor Clark spoke about his development of a new method for recycling food waste, in particular, the industrial quantities of orange peel left over from the process of making orange juice. Brazil creates 3 million tons of this stuff every year, and so the team at York are exploring the use of microwaves as part of a process to extract valuable chemicals from the peel and render the waste more useful for biofuels. For Science Weekly, producer Jason spoke to Professor Clark and started out by asking, why the focus on orange peel?
We chose orange peel as one particular example because it is available in very large quantities. It's already concentrated in certain regions, notably Brazil, but also in China, United States, and parts of Southern Europe and Africa as well. And it's also chemically very interesting. So it's already there. It's not being used for very much at the moment. So we saw enormous potential for its use for making chemicals. There's different ways you can actually convert it into chemicals. The technology we've been focusing on is microwave technology. And the reason for this is because we've proven this to be a very energy efficient method of converting biomass in a general sense into useful products. And we found that actually when you microwave orange peel, by adjusting the temperature of the microwave process, you can do anything from just extract the essential chemicals, limonene being the most famous, through to actually doing chemistry inside the peel when it's in the microwave and starting to make some very valuable other chemicals and materials. So we can make a range of chemicals. Apart from limonene, we can make something called terpineol, which is a very interesting fragrance chemical. We can make some very interesting forms of porous cellulose, which could then be used, for example, for water purification, trapping, separations, and various applications. We can make sugars, which are suitable for fermentation, to make bioethanol. And we can adjust the process to allow us to make a combination of different types of those products to suit the needs.
We traditionally now recycle biomass in very specific ways, but what you're saying is you divert that biomass into a kind of microwave biorefinery to literally take valuable chemicals out of it before it could re-enter our normal ways of recycling biomass. Is that what you're suggesting?
Yes, and I think, you know, when you say we normally recycle biomass, in fact, I'd qualify that and say we recycle some of it, and a lot of it we don't recycle at all. A lot of biomass is simply wasted. It's put into landfill sites or it's burned just to get rid of. And the material that we do recycle, we tend to be doing quite simple things with, such as anaerobic digestion, which is useful for making energy, but to me is a waste of all the enormous chemical potential that you actually have in the food supply chain waste, such as orange peel.
You claimed in your presentation a little bit earlier that effectively this process doubles the calorific count of the biomass. Could you explain that a little bit?
Sure. This is general for food supply chain waste. So if you take various straws, peels, all sorts of different food waste, what you can do in the microwave, if you want to make a solid energy product, something that could be mixed up with coal, for example, for burning at a power station, is if you microwave it first, what it does is it changes the chemical composition, it densifies it, it removes the water. What you end up with is something much more dense with a much higher calorific value. It's about double what you start off with. And that means if you're transporting it, for example, you're transporting a lot less weight. If you then want to mix it in with coal, which people often do, it mixes much better with the coal, and it's also much higher energy content.
So it's almost like a charcoal process.
It is similar to a charcoal process, yes.
Could you give us some idea of what this sort of process, this OPEC biorefinery, would look like? I know that you're proposing that it's mobile in a sense that you move it to large quantities of biomass rather than waste energy by transporting biomass to the processor. What would it actually physically look like? You're building a demo at the moment, I believe.
We are building a demo. So the demo that we're building at the University of York, which is called the Biorenewables Development Centre, will contain a number of technologies, one of which is microwave. And the idea is that these will be machines which are purpose-built, which allow us to work with tens of kilograms an hour of feedstock. And this, we believe, is at the right sort of scale to persuade industry, for example, that this is something that can be done at a commercial scale. So if it was a microwave, what it would look like is it could be almost any size you like, from a small typical kitchen size microwave, different design but similar size, all the way through to something. The biggest one I've seen is about 20 tons an hour of continuous feed. You can't really get much bigger than that. But if you did want to go larger, you could have a whole series of these running in parallel. That's perfectly feasible.
What's the timescale for your demo build? When will you see that particular machine come online?
The demo build will be ready by the end of the year. So in fact, we'll be having open days from January at the latest.
We wish Professor Clark and his team well and have every intention of sending producer Jason to visit his new microwave biomass recycling system when it's up and running. The word recycle does make me happy, even if the cleaning of a recently emptied recycling food bin does not. And it was happiness that was the subject of a presentation by the director of Action for Happiness, Mark Williamson. Producer Jason met Mark to discuss some of the science behind his campaign and started by asking about the contagious nature of happiness.
I think all of us have experienced that sense of somebody else's mood affecting our mood, whether that's receiving an angry email or a smile or positive interaction from a friend or colleague. So I think we all know intuitively that our mood can be affected by others. But we now have some really interesting sort of long-term scientific studies that show that effect, not actually just between two people, but actually throughout social networks in quite a profound way. So a recent study looked at a group of people that were connected loosely in a social network and looked at their moods and looked at the influence of their emotions, both happiness and unhappiness, if you like, on others around them. And they found that actually not only does our happiness and our mood affect our friends, it affects our friends' friends' friends. So through 3 degrees of separation, because of the sort of contagious impact of our mood affecting others and their mood mood in turn affecting the people they come into contact with. So I think that's quite empowering and quite interesting, because it means that almost whether we like it or not, we affect how other people around us feel. People who've been looking at, for example, the mirror neurons in our brain now know that when we see somebody else in pleasure or see somebody else in pain, it actually fires similar mirror neurons, if you like, in our own brain. And so we have a sense of now an understanding in our brain of how empathy works, why it is that we do care about other people's pleasure and pain. And actually, it turns out that although the sort of survival of the fittest tendency, the selfish gene, if you like, is obviously a strong evolutionary tendency to want to survive and outdo others, if you like, we also have now a recognition that we're actually hardwired to care about each other. And when we do things to help others, it actually fires the same aspects of our brain that fire and light up when we do things that bring ourselves pleasure. So giving is actually good for us.
We spend a lot of time just trying to discover things about unhappiness and about illness and about sickness. I take it your campaign is to try and address a kind of sort of perceptive fault in social policy and how we look at ourselves, which is to say that we need to perhaps look at how we value good functionality, things that are working, things that are beneficial. Is that fair?
I think that's a really good way of summarising it. And a great way of illustrating this is to look at what's happened in the field of psychology in recent decades. For generations, psychology has been looking at deficits, if you like. And quite rightly, it's essential that we help people that are most in need. But the majority of psychology research have been looking at how do we help fix people who are broken, in broadest terms. And Professor Martin Seligman in the United States began a revolution in thinking about what's now been termed positive psychology. And that's looking really at assets rather than deficits. It's saying what are the contributing factors to leading a happy, fulfilling life, not just what are the factors that affect people who are really struggling with anxiety and depression and serious mental illness. And I think that sort of shift in thinking is needed across society as a whole. So of course we care deeply about people at most in need and people who are unhappy. The role of my organisation, Action for Happiness, is to help create and encourage a happier society. And one of the most important aspects of that is alleviating misery. But if we just focus on that, on those deficits, we fail in that mission. Because in fact, our mental health, like our physical health, is a spectrum that all of us are on. And we all have the ability to fall the wrong way on that spectrum, and also to help the people around us when they're struggling. So that's why I think a focus on happiness and what the components are of a flourishing, thriving life is so important.
You do specifically refer to a psychological state. You use the term high psychological well-being as a kind of another way of looking at happiness. And that this high psychological well-being starts to impact in very kind of specific ways, very tangible ways. You spoke a little bit about the fact that in productivity terms, there's definitely good science that proves that high psychological well-being individuals, happy individuals, are more creative and more productive. Could you give us an example of that, tangible example of that? Specifically, you mentioned a study by Barbara Fredrickson, was it, about the idea that those triggers that we usually think, such as fright or flight, fear, in a way, focus us. Looking at that it's not fright or flight that really helps to focus, but other aspects of our mental capacity.
Well, the fight or flight mechanism is long understood and is very important. It's an essential evolutionary mechanism for helping us to identify and focus on risks to our well-being and in many cases get the hell out of there. So when we experience fear and anger, in many ways they're narrowing down our focus. We're shutting out superfluous influences, things on the horizon that are irrelevant, and we're focusing on the immediate risk. That's essential. We need that. And sometimes in our working lives and our home lives, that sense of urgency and fear is important. But what we now know is that positive emotions, the opposite of fear and anger, so joy, pleasure, contentment, pride, compassion, and so on, these feelings don't just feel nice, but they have in many ways an evolutionary reason for them. And that is what Barbara Fredrickson has termed to broaden and build our capabilities. And what that means is that people, while experiencing positive emotions, are more likely to look outwards and across the horizon and see new opportunities to connect things that they may not otherwise connect. So really, in a workplace context, that is a driver of creativity, of innovation, of new ideas. And that broadening also then builds our capacity. So when difficult times happen, we're better able to be resilient and cope with difficult times. So there's a real, you know, positive emotions don't just feel good, they really benefit our capability.
Big thanks there to Mark Williamson. You can get more information on Action for Happiness by checking out their website, actionforhappiness.org. That's all we have for this special British Science Festival edition of Science Weekly. For more information on the festival, go to their website, britishscienceassociation.org. You can keep up to speed with breaking science news at any time, of course, on guardian.co.uk/science. Next week, we have another treat in store for you. We're taking Science Weekly on the road and we'll be recording the podcast in front of a live audience at the Natural History Museum here in London. It's all part of the museum's Science Uncovered event, taking place on Friday the 23rd of September. So, if you're in London and want to be in the audience for that recording, just email us your full name, your affiliation and your contact number to scienceweeklypodcast@gmail.com. Just put live recording in the subject line as well to mark your email out. Then we'll send you further instructions on how to join in the fun. But from me, Alok Jha, and Science Weekly producer Jason Phipps, it's goodbye.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.